Mr. Tapley, I understand you were the first railroad station agent for the Madawaska area.
You want me to repeat what I said? No, I wasn't. There was a man before me, a Mr. Roy Bard, and he left for a vacation for a couple of weeks, and he never came back, so I stayed here.
What year was it, Mr. Tapley?
That was May 1911.
Where was the railroad station at the time?
A little below the location where it is now.
Right here in Madawaska?
Yeah.
Was the first railroad station there, or was it in St. David?
No, it was here.
It was right here in Madawaska?
Yeah, right alongside the old ferry road. And it was an old refinished boxcar.
Oh, how interesting. how long did this old boxcar serve as the station?
Well, they built the new station building that summer. And that was right in practically the same location, only it was on the north or west side of the ferry road.
Now, was this ferry road? Where would the location be today? What could we compare it to?
Well, it took off right where the Daigle Furniture Store is now, practically down through that valley and across the track and down to a road through the ferry. At that time, we only had a ferry here. That was before the bridge was built.
This was in 1911, you say. Now, why is it that they had a railroad station up in Fort Kent at the time, but they had none here in Madawaska? What seemed to be the reason why they had bypassed Madawaska?
This Fort Kent branch, so-called, from Van Buren to Fort Kent, was built quite a few years after the Ashland branch, which went in to Fort Kent.
Now, approximately what year did that Ashland branch come through to Fort Kent?
I don't know the exact date, but I say it's approximately 10 years before they built this branch up this way.
And what year was it that the B&A did come through Madawaska?
1910. They built it was built to Grand Isle before that, a year or so before that. And the following year, they completed this section from Grand Isle to Fort Kent. That would be 1910.
And when you came as a station agent, the railroad had already been laid down, right?
Oh, yes. Operation. It had gone on operation the fall before, in 1910.
Now, had it completed its route straight through the St. Francis in 1911, beyond Fort Kent, do you remember?
That I don't remember, no.
Because what do they call the place where they turn the locomotive around? At the end of the line.
The turntable.
The turntable.
Yeah.
So I remember when we were little, we used to go to St. Francis and see the train turn. Now, was there ever a railroad station down in St. David?
Oh, yes. That was opened about the same time this one was. They had stations at Keegan, Notre Dame, Lille, Grand Isle, St. David, Madawaska, Frenchville, and St. Louis. All had open stations with agents in charge when the road was finally finished through to Fort Kent.
Now, I don't want to sound nosy, but could you tell me just what you got for a salary?
I don't remember exactly, but I think it was around $75 a month for a 12-hour day.
Salaries have certainly changed, haven't they?
And that was supposed to be a good job in those days. Mm-hmm.
Now, just what were your duties as a station agent?
Well, we had the freight, of course, and the American Express and the Western Union, all in the same station. And I took charge of all of them, tried to.
Now, for the Western Union, that was the... What were your duties for the Western Union?
Just to send and receive telegrams.
And the what was the other one?
The American Express.
Oh, yes. Now, what did that include?
Well, they handled practically all the parcel business in those days. There was no parcel post then.
The American Express. And whenever anybody mailed a package out of the area, it went through this
Express,
particular branch. And that was handled by the Bangor Rooster, right?
Well, they, yes, in a way, but the Express Company had what they called a messenger on each train who handled all the Express packages.
Oh, yes. And generally, this messenger was a local person, or was he?
No. He was hired by the Express Company. And that train that used to run through here originated at Holton. They went to Oakfield, or what was then Old Ashland Junction, up to Squawpan, across what we call the Mapleton Cutoff, to Stockholm, on to Van Buren, and up through here to Fort Kent. And after I don't know whether that was before or afterwards, but they afterwards went through to St. Francis, where the crew stayed overnight. They started out there the next morning. I can always remember the time of the morning train here was 9:10. And the afternoon passenger train was 5:15 in Madawaska. And besides that, we had a freight each day. That usually, I don't exactly remember, but I think they started from Van Buren in the afternoon, or rather they left at Fort Kent or St. Francis in the morning and run to Van Buren and then doubled back in the afternoon. They handled all the heavier stuff, carload stuff, less carload freight. And there was quite a passenger business here. I was telling someone the other day that I used to sell us, when they started to build the mill here, I used to sell as high as $1,000 worth of tickets a month.
Now, where were most of these passengers going to, Mr. Tapper?
A good part of them were local, going to Van Buren, Fort Kent, and other stations along the way. Although we did, of course, get some what we call interline passengers, people going to Boston and Portland and so forth.
Now, I imagine that was quite an occasion when somebody bought a ticket to go to Boston.
No, it wasn't too unusual.
It wasn't.
No. And after the mill started up here, well, we had a lot of construction workers in here from long distances away. We'd often sell a ticket to far away Chicago, which increased the ticket sales a whole lot. I don't remember. I estimate $1,000 there, but perhaps it ran more than that some months when they were busy on construction.
So when Fraser did their build on this side of the river, that really brought some activity into the community then.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Madawaska was only a whistle stop before that, so called.
And it certainly has come a long way now. Why, they have their, Fraser has their own cars and everything for their product. So most of the freight leaving the area, Mr. Tapley, before Fraser came in, just what was it made up of, the freight? You said the heavy stuff went out on the freight.
Well, we didn't have any great volume of traffic from Madawaska, but it consisted mostly of potatoes, pulpwood, and hay. In those days, they shipped quite a lot of carloads of hay to the Boston market.
And how was the hay transported? I mean, was it in a bulk car like we have?
No, in a box car and bales.
Bales. And then what was some of the incoming merchandise?
It was mostly less carload freight for the stores. There was very little, until the Fraser came here, there was very little carload freight coming in that I remember of. Mostly what we call less carload freight. That was stuff that the train crew unloaded into the freight shed. We had a big two-door freight shed here at that time, in addition to the station building. And that was unloaded, what they call less carload items, in the freight shed. And it was my job to look after that, deliver, collect the bills.
Oh, you delivered it also?
No, just from the freight shed, that's all. No.
And no,
the storekeepers all had their own truck teams. In those days, we used to get quite a lot of freight for the Edmondson stores. We used to buy various items on this side.
Well,
take them across the river on the ferry.
And were they as strict with their custom laws as they are now, or did people get away without the tariff, paying the tariff?
Well, yes and no. They weren't very fussy about small items, as I remember, but on the larger items, well, they collected the duty, same as they do today.
And was the custom, was there a custom house here in Madawaska for the ferry boat?
No. Not when I first arrived here. The customs office was where the library is today, and one of our old settlers here, Remy Daigle, was the customs officer. And if they had anything, well, which was dutiful, they up to the office, and occasionally he'd meet the ferry, you know, inspect the people coming.
Well, then they left it up to the honesty of the individual to declare.
Oh, yes.
With...
yes, more or less.
They don't trust us much now. They're right,
no.
They're right at the end of the bridge, right?
Yeah.
Mr. Tapley, a while back you had given me a little program of the events that took place of the actual inauguration of the opening of the bridge here.
Yeah.
Right. Do you remember in what year that was?
1929, wasn't it? Do you have that yet?
Yes, we had it at the library, yes.
Oh, I think it was 1929.
29? I don't remember.
Well, it's on the program.
Yeah. And were you there when this took, they had these festivities?
Yes.
Opening of the group. Could you tell me who some of the dignitaries were that were there?
Well, they're all on that program.
Yes,
I could name them offhand. I know that, if I remember right, the governor, Baxter, at the time was there, and the premier of New Brunswick was there also. And then there were various other people from Edmondson, Madawaska, and up and down the river, if I remember correctly. The names of all the dignitaries are on that program.
Now, Did they have, besides serving this banquet over in Edmonton, did they have a parade of any kind?
No.
Was it something that the local citizenry were looking forward to, or was it more or less an accepted thing?
I imagine they all look forward to it in a way, because there were speakers there. Quite a menu, as you will notice.
Yes,
the program.
Quite elaborate. Getting back to the railroads, the Madawaska had been settled by the French people in the latter 1700s. Now, they, reading through the history books, that they had been bringing materials in from the St. Lawrence area, St. Lawrence River region, by railroad. Now, what railroad were they using if the Bangor and Rosic just came in 1911?
At that time, there were no railroads into Madawaska or Edmonton, were there?
I don't know. I'm asking you.
The Temiskwata, from River Lou to Connors, came through Edmonton. And I don't know whether the Temiskwata was the first railroad into Edmonton or the CPR. The CNR was building when I came here. In fact, they didn't start running trains until the following year, 1912. But the CPR and the Temiskwata were in full operation when I came here. Just what years they came into Edmonton, I didn't know.
And you said that this Temiskwata came in from River Duluth?
Yeah.
And in through Clare and...
No, it came down through Cabinot and Notre Dame to Edmonton and then up the river. Connors.
Now, I imagine the reason why I used to go to Connors is such an isolated place. It's really the end of the road.
It was the end of the line.
Yeah. I imagine this was for the lumber that came out of the area.
Mostly, I think.
But still,
lumber and supplies for the lumber.
Were you familiar with the story of what's his name? Connors, that was up there. This gentleman, he's quite a lumberman, and they have all sorts of legends concerning his disappearance for a number of years. Are you familiar with that story at all?
No.
They have a little Protestant church up there in Connors, and they have a great big tombstone, you know. I was wondering if you knew the story.
No, I don't.
He built this, really this, old Victorian style type of home up there. Romeo Bernier is in that home now. And according to what I think was in the Fraser story that I read, some of the lumbermen that used to get hurt, you know, on woods, he used to keep them, to hire them to take care of the grounds of his beautiful home. He was quite a controversial person, from what I hear. I was wondering if you had heard, knew anything about him.
No, I never heard the full story. I know something about the house, because I was been quite well acquainted with the Bernier family. In fact, one of Joe Bro. Gloria Daigle's mother. It's her brother that lives in that house now, and I know she would always want me to go up and look it over. She says it's a beautiful place. But I never questioned her about Connors.
The legend has it that he disappeared for a number of years. He got involved with some type of tax difficulties or something, and he went underground for I don't know how many years, and there was this casket that had been delivered on to Temiskwata there at Connors, saying that it was a body of, what was his name? Is it Robert? Bob Connors. They have a little cemetery up there. I don't know if you've seen it. And I have a sister-in-law that's related to these people, and they all renovated the little cemetery, and it looks real nice. All the Congress people that first came there. Yes, well, so this is sort of getting away from our railroad.
Yes.
Well, if there's anything else, Mr. Tapley, that you think would be interesting to contribute to something like this, a way of life that, you know, this here is being taped for future generations when there'll be no more track left, no more sign of what's past, you know. And this is why they have asked us to interview people your age. Historians can record, but their own personal opinion always comes through the writing. But the vocal interview, you can't...
Well, the only thing that might be interesting in that respect is the maintenance of the railroad and the roadbed. They had in those days, altogether different from what it is today, they had a section crew, which usually consisted of a foreman and three men, and they used the old pump hand cars. And they, each section crew, maintained 4 miles of track. See, and the snow removal in the winter, of course, and grading and putting in new ties and that sort of thing in the summer. But the snow removal was quite a problem in those days. Now, I can remember even after Frasers came here, you know, they used to, instead of doing with machines, they used to shovel that whole yard by hand. Sometimes they would, after a big storm like we had a few days ago, they'd probably have 50 extra snow shovels. The section foreman hired them, kept their time, turned their time into me, and I sent that into the the general accounting office, and they issued the checks, and it was my job to deliver those checks when they arrived, which was another job which I didn't get paid anything extra for, by the way.
But all the obligations that a person had today with the unions, you'd have probably just taken care, you'd have probably been a paymaster and that was it, or Western Union. But as it is, then you did everything, you were jack of all trades.
Yes. One thing that I always objected to was my job to keep the station platform clear.
Uh-huh.
And that was real hard work, because we had about well, the platform extended through the freight shed and a little beyond. And I used to have to get out in the morning and clean that off, which was good exercise.
Oh, goodness. How long were you station agent here in the middle?
About 20 years.
In all those 20 years, what do you say was probably the most shocking or hair-raising experience you had as an agent for the railroad?
I don't remember anything right at the present time. I know we never had any bad wrecks on this section of the line that I remember of. Of course, there were derailments and so on and so forth, but everything seemed to went along quite smoothly, as far as I can remember.
And do you remember of any big politician coming to the area by the railroad, any reception committee at the station to meet anybody in particular?
No, I don't. I remember Senator Brewster coming up here several times, but I just don't remember whether he came by railroad or by car.
No robberies at all?
I did have one robbery at the station, yes. They didn't get anything. But,
Did they catch the thief?
Yes.
It's better than they are today, huh?
And we had a safe there. And it was a youngster from across the river. He got in there at night, broke in through a window, and he tried to pry the safe open, but he didn't succeed. He did pry the combination off and do quite a lot of damage to the safe, but he didn't get inside. That, and when we were the first few years I was agent, we had no safe. The company didn't furnish a safe, and we were responsible for the cash, and they wouldn't let us leave it in the station. We always used to have to carry it home with us at night. Sometimes we'd have quite a bit of money for those days, and I was always a little worried over that, but I never was robbed. Always managed to see. There was no bank here, and we had to send our cash receipts for the railroad to the treasurer in Bangor. And when we had an amount of over $20, I suppose, we had to list that up on something like a deposit slip you have today, put it in a heavy brown envelope, seal it with wax, sew it, mind you, a string around the end of it, and seal it with wax. And that went free, of course, but the express messenger had to give us a receipt for it. Now the express funds were handled the same way, but those went to Boston, to the, they had, the express company had an accounting office in Boston at that time, a branch office. It wasn't the general accounting office, I think the general accounting office in New York. And we had to make, that was a job, we had to make monthly reports. And we had to list up every item by item, on sheets, add them up. And they were supposed to be correct, and we had no adding machine. That's why I tell the girls at the shopping center there, you know, that when I gather up three or four items, I know exactly what they are.
Yes, yes.
In those days.
Yeah. You were a human adding machine.
Yeah.
We've come a long way, haven't we? When the car, the automobile came into the valley, would you remember just what date that was?
Well, I don't think there was there were any automobiles that I remember in the valley when I came here in 1911. Although some people have told me that Frank Fournier, who was postmaster for years at St. David, did have a car that year. But the first car that I remember coming to Edmondson was in the following summer. There was a barber over there that bought a Ford, and it was such a curiosity that we used to run to the door and watch it go by. But outside of that one, that Frank Fournier did have that car that summer. He went on shortly after anyway, I know. It was the first automobile that I remember.
I imagine it was a topic of discussion. I imagine when the first few automobiles came into the...
Oh, yeah. Very exciting. I think Frank's car was a Metz, chain driven. It had a chain from the motor somewhere underneath there to the rear axle. Just pretty like bicycle chains today. That would be a curiosity today.
I should say so. Now, was it operated with pedals? Did they pedal or did they use gas?
No. It was a gas operator.
Ms. Taffy, you were around when World War One was declared. Now, did you notice any big migration of our boys leaving? Was there quite, you know, did they leave in groups, or did they just go one at a time? Do you remember that?
Well, the only group that I remember was a group from St. David. It was Francis Sear, Jim Sear, Tommy Sear, and two of the others whose names I remember them because I knew them all well. And I've always remembered Tommy Sear when he got on the train, shook hands with me and said, "I won't be back." And he didn't. He came back, but
and he's
dead. He's on the post is named after, Tommy Sear. I remember that. It's funny, that's always stuck in my memory.
How old was Mr.?
Oh, I suppose he was in his early 20s, perhaps. 20. Another thing that has nothing to do with railroad affair, which might be interesting to somebody. I was turned down on account of health. Suspected TB in the First World War. See, I was right at the age when I was draftable. I went to Fort Fairfield for my examination and they turned me down, put me in what they called a 4F class. Suspected TB, you know, and I got over it and I'm still here.
And a lot of the
60 years after. And I did really have TB because it's shown up in x-rays that I've had taken, the scars has shown up in x-rays that I've had taken since. Because I remember I went down to the Olay Clinic all back about 25 or 30 years ago for treatment. And they took all kinds of x-rays, of course, and the doctor there asked me if I'd ever had TB. Well, I said they suspected it, but I never knew for sure. They said you did because they said you still have scars on your lungs.
Were you treated? Did you go to the sanitarium at all?
No.
Did the doctors give you any kind of medication?
No.
You just up more than
there were no sanatoriums at that time.
One in Prescott was not up.
No. I went to a doctor in Bristol, old Dr. Dobson, after I came back. And, well, he more or less confirmed it, but what he told me to do says get outdoors as much as you can. And I did. That's when I took up fishing. And I did get over it.
Isn't that something? Because I know several people that spend months in the sanitarium. Do you remember who we had for doctors in Mattawa?